It is Sunday, late September. I left my house yesterday, Saturday, about 9:30 in the morning, and I didn't arrive here in Europe until about 1 p.m. And that's quite a long work day, but here I am now in Brussels at the canal, and you sort of then can forget the very long journey on the way over. But I do this about 5 times a month, and the passengers after one flight are always like, oh, I just hate this. And it's like, oh no, I do it all the time. When I was a child, I was fascinated with Star Trek. The Star Trek theme, just a slight tweak of it, is sort of my life mission statement. And it's like, travel, the final frontier. These are the voyages of Betty Thesky. My life mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out life in different civilizations, to boldly go where very few single gals have gone before.
Betty in the sky with a suitcase. Boarding now. Journey start, America.
Hi, I'm Betty Thesky. I'm a flight attendant for a major American airline, a job I've been doing for more than 25 years. The job's taken me to over 50 countries, and it's allowed me to meet literally millions of passengers. It's led me to write 2 books and record my own podcast, Betty in the Sky, which I've been presenting for more than 8 years now. Today, on the BBC World Service, I want to share with you what life's really like at 36,000 feet. From angry customers and acts of kindness, to flirting with passengers and dealing with medical emergencies. Not, I should add, at the same time. And as the BBC World Service continues its 100 Women series, I'll explain what life's like as a single gal who's constantly on the move. So join me as we fly from Atlanta to Brussels to Barcelona and London before heading home to South Carolina. But we should start where my story starts, as a child in Pittsburgh.
So with a smile and a handshake, it's all aboard.
I think I was probably under 4 when I thought, I want to get out of Pittsburgh and I want to see the world and I want to do things. It's really fortunate to be able to realize what you want at a young age, because you can't form a path to something if you don't know where you're going or where you want to go. So I knew I wanted to travel, and by getting a job at the airline, and I never will become rich as a flight attendant, but I became travel rich, which was more important to me. I was 21 when I started at the airline. This is my 3rd airline, and no one I knew traveled. People I grew up with, they moved down the street from their parents and never even went out of their time zone in the United States. So if I want to travel and I don't have any money, I didn't see any opportunities except for like marrying a wealthy man. It's like probably the only other way I could travel. So I look at it in a certain way, like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, where, you know, you win the golden ticket. And the golden ticket isn't money. It's the experience of going to the chocolate factory. And I actually, by getting a job at the airline, won a ticket to experience, a ticket to travel.
They call you Lady Luck.
My first trip was to Las Vegas. I went out and bought a new dress. I didn't realize the crews lots of times don't dress up that much. And I was all decked out. I was just so excited to go to Las Vegas. And my second trip was to Hawaii. Like, I just couldn't believe that, you know, in 1 week I could be going to Las Vegas and Hawaii for work.
Destination number 1, Brussels.
Oh, here we go. More local music. It's folk music here in Brussels. And so often I end up in the middle of something just by chance. And today is a big day where everybody's out and everybody's biking and there's marionettes and there's tents and there's people selling things. There's horses going by. Even if there wasn't a festival going on, this square is just unbelievable. The buildings are covered in gold leaf. It's shockingly beautiful. And the fact that it's so old and that everything is still all intact, that you can be here, I never ever get tired of, even if I'm tired. I get out on the street and look at this. You're in the Grand Platz in Brussels. Mysteriously, I'm not tired anymore. Just definitely will wake you up and wake up just the travel spirit in you. It's fun. A good day at work. A good day just means you don't have any problems with the passengers, with the baggage, people yelling. But for me, a good day at work is, like, I like to go to Paris. And a good day at work for Paris is, you know, you get on board and you get to be smiley and nice, and people are smiley and nice back to you because they're excited about going to Paris. And then you do the beverage service, and you do the meal service, and then you do coffee service. And one of the things that people don't realize is then you get to take a nap. And most jobs, you don't get to take a nap at work. Now you're just being nice. Sometimes you get to talk to interesting people in the downtime. And then you're landing in Paris. And we don't even go through the Charles de Gaulle Airport. We have a van that pulls up under the jetway. And we just go out with our bags down the stairs onto the bus that takes us straight to the hotel. So it can be a really good day at work. There's actually a lot of bad days. Because you are dealing with literally thousands of people on a domestic trip. You can easily hit 1,000 people. And if you think of 1,000 people and 1,000 people's problems and 1,000 people's personalities and 1,000 people's ailments, and then you're trapped in a metal tube with nowhere to go, all kinds of things can happen. Like literally every single thing that happens in life eventually happens on the plane because of just the sheer number of people you're dealing with. The behavior I dislike the most in passengers is when we do have medical emergencies on board, and it's important, and it's stressful, and it's somebody's health, and we're making a PA for a doctor, and we have a bunch of medical equipment on board, and we're running around literally like chickens with our heads cut off because somebody's unconscious. So we've got the emergency medical kit, we've got the defibrillator out, there can be IVs, there can be all these things, and then there will be a passenger that says, excuse me, can I have a pillow? And you're like, excuse me, I need a Diet Coke. And you want to say, well, you're kidding me, right? I got somebody who's unconscious here. You've seen us running around, you've heard us paging for a doctor, it's a medical emergency, and you want something so trivial as a Diet Coke. So that's the thing that actually really gets to me. I've been flying a long time, and actually I think my patience is pretty good, but there are certain times where, you know, you just sort of had it. People are always asking my favorite places, and I have so many, but I can narrow it down. And they have basically been places that have been magical in my mind. One is Easter Island. It's the most remote place on Earth that people live. It's a 4-hour flight from Santiago, Chile, and the next closest thing is Tahiti. It's like the world's largest outdoor museum. I mean, you still see tools scattered around. There's so few people there. There's only like 3,000 people living there. You're like getting to see a museum and actually walk right up to it. Another one is the Galapagos, because I like wildlife so much, and the Galapagos are so beautiful without all the crazy wildlife, without the blue-footed boobies and the penguins and the sea lions and the giant turtles. It would still be a great vacation destination, but when you put thousands of giant lizards, you know, just walking down the beach, that place to me was really a traveler's dream. I do believe the world is getting smaller just because the access to getting places is definitely getting smaller. But I do not believe that the world is getting similar because there's lots of places still that you can go where life is extremely different than what your life at home is. And there are places you can go where people live the same way they lived, you know, 400 years ago. There's like the San Blas Islands in Panama. They have the Kuna Indians there where they still wear their hair and the bowl haircut and they have the beads going up. I mean, and this is Panama. It's like a hop, skip, and a jump from the United States. And here are people living in their indigenous ways. I think it's beautiful that there's still places that are so different and that aren't changed by the internet. And it isn't something you can just Google and see everything before you go. I think there's a lot of benefit to all the information we have online when it comes to traveling, but I also think that in some ways it's kind of sad. You don't want to see everything before you go. You don't want to have everything laid out. You don't want to know exactly what everything's going to look like before you go. I think that that sort of defeats the purpose of going. For me, I like to see the cultures that are almost completely opposite of mine and see how they live and see how we're similar and see how we're different and see how they do things. To me, it's like seeing other worlds and then in return, seeing my own world in a different light from viewing theirs.
I mainly fly international, so in any given month, I could be heading to a European capital, a Middle Eastern city, or a Far East business destination. We call these layovers, and they're the bits of the job where we get to step off the plane, step out of our uniforms, and immerse ourselves in the local culture.
Destination number 2, Barcelona.
When I'm on a layover, say like this layover in Barcelona, we have 24 hours, but actually I don't really have 24 hours because I have to sleep for 2 nights. So if you take a normal person, so that's like 16 hours, and then you take getting to and from the airport, which we all know, and security and all that, I literally only have, honestly, it doesn't sound nearly as glamorous, but I only really have 5 hours. But you know, you can do a lot in 5 hours, but that's also troubling in that there's a lot of things you can do and I only have 5 hours. Sitting on the beach here in Barcelona, looking out at the water and the sailboats, and you realize that a lot of people would save a good portion of their lifetime or have a dream, like I want to go to Barcelona. And here I am, sitting here, I've got 4 or 5 hours on a layover, and then it's back to work. What most people would be a big trip, for me it's like a little capsule, but it's a capsule that you can really appreciate if you remember to think about it. I lots of times venture out on my own because I want to see and do things. I'm in Paris, or I'm in Brussels, or I'm in Rome, and I take off running. I get on comfortable shoes and I try to see and do as much as possible. And actually, I really think of it as a real luxury. Before I go on a trip, I'll look to see, you know, events in Paris in September, and I go to gallery openings and I go to wine tastings. I actually get to go to wine tastings in Paris at work. I will do the museums, but I tend to do the museums after I've been to a place a few times because I'd rather see the local lifestyle than the museums. But after I've been, you know, to Paris 100 times, it's nice to go to the Louvre, you know.
Those who can afford it go by air, and flight can give you more than a change of scenery. It can take you where your world ends and another begins. But whether it's Paris or Pontypridd, the old last-minute excitement is the same. Where did I put that ticket? Wonder if I remember to pack my fruit sauce. However you travel for your weekend, it's still the time when dreams find wings and fly.
It used to be an event to fly, and people dressed up, and it was exciting, and they looked nice. And now it's very rare. I actually compliment people when I see someone dressed nice, because everybody's in sweatpants and flip-flops. And I think it reflects the attitude that people have towards air travel, is they don't think it's exciting. They think it's a chore, so they dress the same way they would when they go to the gym, grocery store. It's kind of sad. The golden age of air travel was the Pan Am jet set days. So I would say that was the 60s, 70s, even up part of the 80s. They were treated like models. They were treated like movie stars. When they walked through the airplane, you know, everybody watched and everybody wanted to be them, and they dated movie stars. And it really was a profession that people aspired to. People forget that it used to take 4 days to drive across the United States. I recently did it. The next time I was on a flight from LA to the East Coast, I wanted to say, you know, this could take you 4 days. And you get to sit here and have a drink and you have a snack and you can watch a movie. And the thing that gets me is that it's only been a decade that things have changed so much that passengers now get extremely upset, like violently upset, if their television screen doesn't work, the little screen in front of them. And 30 years ago, it was the idea of getting from one place to another, not what you were going to watch along the way. And we have forgotten that you used to have to take a ship across the Atlantic Ocean. But I do wish that people realized that it really is sort of amazing that you can get to Europe in 7 or 8 hours. You know, the world has become very small. I do wonder what's the difference between the glamour days of the jet set Pan Am and today, because the basic tenets are the same. And if anything, the airplanes are nicer and have more amenities. My only explanation is that it's post 9/11, it's post terrorism. It's actually people, because of the security and because of the security lines and taking your shoes off and taking your belt off. Just that aspect has put a negative spin on something that used to be a treat. And that little bit of difficulty, security, has changed the whole concept of air travel. I think that's a little crazy.
26 years on, I still love most aspects of my job. But every job has its downsides. And while the good experiences are great, the bad days can be distressing beyond words.
Terrorists attack the heart of America with catastrophic loss of life. Hijacked planes smash into and destroy New York's tallest buildings.
I wasn't on one of the flights of 9/11, but I was right in that area. I was just leaving Hartford, and we were actually flying over the New York airspace right at the same time. We had just finished the service, and I got a call, and, you know, the call is usually that, you know, the pilot wants coffee or something like that. And, you know, they said that, you know, planes have just hit the World Trade Center, and it was like, what? And a lot of people that work for the airline industry never really recovered. A lot of people quit. I like to explain it to people that people who had cracks before 9/11, they spun out, you know. They ended up quitting. People got into drugs. You know, it's not spoken about very often, but, you know, the flight attendants, you know, they were right in the thick of things, and they lost their lives. And a lot of people felt like, you know, it wasn't worth the risk. You know, it was too risky. It wasn't worth it. And I never even thought twice about leaving the airline industry, but a good percentage of people did. That was it for them. If a plane crash happens, or hijacking, any of those types of things, you know, it's a reminder that, you know, you are in an industry where there's legitimate risks, you know. Also, if you look at, I mean, there's so many statistics that, you know, it's much more dangerous to drive and all those things. And I do think it's extremely safe. I've actually been flying 26 years, and I've only had like a couple engines blow. I've had to foam the runway maybe once because we didn't know if the landing gear was going to come down. But really, in 26 years of high time flying, I'd say, you know, it's pretty gosh darn safe.
Destination number 3, London.
It's another day. It's another layover. I'm here in London in Covent Garden. And what I love about London is I love the theater. I love the taxis. I love the food. And I can't wait to have a good look around here in Covent Garden. I've never been here before.
I think it's sad in this day and age that a lot of people still have stereotypes about what being a flight attendant is like, even what being a woman is like. Too many people assume we're on the lookout for a husband or a more casual encounter. I think things are getting better, slowly, and those people will start to realize that a woman might enjoy being independent and enjoy traveling for traveling's sake.
I'm single, and I actually really like being single. Because I like to travel and I like to meet new people, and it's fun, you know. Actually, it doesn't happen that often for me, but every few years, like, fall in love and you feel like a teenager again. It's really fun. But I think that I'm rare in that respect. I think most women, or historically, most women have wanted a long-term relationship. So maybe my job at the airline has cost me that, but considering that wasn't my focus and it wasn't my goal, I don't feel like it has. Even though I meet millions of people or see millions of people, it's actually not a conducive place to actually like making a date. It's hard to flirt with someone on the window with the other two people. There's not a lot of downtime. People think you meet a lot of people, and actually people have the perception that you meet a lot of people, and lots of times it's not the case. And the few times that I have dated someone that I met on the plane, I've had to say something to them, or I've had to actually initiate something. And they almost always say, well, you must get hit on all the time. And it's like, no, not really. No, not as much as you think.
Our girls have chosen to make a career for themselves as air hostesses. And here's one reporting for duty at the Amsterdam Drome of the KLM service.
There's a lot of stereotypes with being a woman. There's also a lot of stereotypes with being a flight attendant. I notice a lot of stereotypes when you're traveling as a woman. There are places in the world where people are surprised you're by yourself. And there are certain times where people don't believe you when you tell them that, no, I'm actually just here to explore and to experience. Being a woman and traveling, there are certain things that you have to do. There's certain precautions you have to take. And sometimes it's sad to me because sometimes there's experiences that I have to say no to just because it's just too risky. And I think if I was a man traveling by myself, I wouldn't have to say no. I was in Jordan and Petra, which is just an amazing, beautiful, it just brought tears to my eyes. And there was a local guy there who was on horseback and he was offering to make me dinner. He's like, I'll take you into Petra at night when there's nobody there and cook dinner on an open fire. And you know, who gets to do that? But you know, I just didn't think it was very prudent to get on a stranger's horse and go into Petra at night, even if he was going to make me dinner by the fire. You know, there is a level of vulnerability when you're traveling alone as a woman.
In their trim uniforms and hat brims at just the right angle, the girls look as if they really enjoyed their job. Though there's plenty of variety, they have many responsibilities.
For some reason, it's a job that lends itself to females. I'm not quite totally sure, really. But it does. And it also means that you're working with a lot of women. I would say that there's a sisterhood to it. There's a family aspect to it. And maybe that's another reason why it lends itself to sort of a female-oriented job. I actually do like when there's a male or two on the crew. It adds a different level. And also, sometimes you need a little strength here and there. Or if there is really a battle, you know, it's nice to have a man around.
The bright personality and self-assurance of the air hostess is reflected in her guests. And her secret, well, it's in the air.
Well, I think originally the reason why so many women were in the job is because the idea from a business perspective was to have pretty young women. They would bring the men on the plane. And that stuck for a long time. And of course, that's all changed with feminism. But I do think that it is suited to women, maybe just because, and I don't want this to sound sexist or anything, but there's a lot of patience involved. You know, I don't know if that has to do with the mother gene or being empathic. One of the big parts of the job is just listening to people complain. And I don't know if that many hot-headed men are that, you know, good at that, like the pilots are not good at that. So maybe that's part of the reason why it has stayed a female-oriented job. When I'm traveling is when I feel the most at home and engaged with the world. It's sometimes hard to explain that to people because most people feel the most at home at home. Every part of you is alive. Everything, especially when you're traveling by yourself, you have to be aware. You have to be on your toes. You have to be hyper alert for any number of reasons. Time is different when you're traveling. It's like a different dimension. I know that sounds silly, but when you're traveling, you have to get on a boat and then you're on a bus and then you're taking a hike through the forest and it's noon. Like, and you've done all this in one day. And I also find myself sometimes, I guess this being a true traveler, is like getting on the plane to come home, I'm kind of already thinking, where am I going to go next? You know, where's my next adventure?
Final destination, South Carolina.
So I'm back home in the United States. I have a few days off and I'm at the beach in South Carolina. There's a plane going by, ironically. People say to me, when are you going to get a real job? And if a real job is in an office working 9 to 5, if that's a professional grown-up job, well, then they can keep it. Some people have described me as having a wanderlust, but I don't think lust is a strong enough word. I have a full-on travel love affair.
I was a flight attendant for 10 years before I realized I could travel for pleasure outside of work, to travel for myself. On one flight, I met an inspirational blind man who told me, if you wait for somebody else, you may wait your whole life. Since then, I've thrown myself into seeing as much of the world as possible, and I've tried to enjoy every destination, every experience, every moment.
I feel like a lot of women, myself included, aim low without even realizing it, or maybe we were taught to aim low. Once I actually started traveling alone is when I started realizing that I could do things and I could handle things, and I've learned to aim higher and that I can aim higher. And just the knowledge that you can aim higher makes the possibilities unlimited. I do think that what makes people happy is the experiences, not the belongings. I'm not into shopping. I'm only there to collect experiences and to collect knowledge and to collect just the joy of getting to travel. So I would think that when most people think they're looking back, I think I'll be happier than most.
Betty in the Sky was an unusual production for the BBC World Service.